We all know what time is intuitively, right? We kind of think about time as the passage of something, right? But it's hard to even wrap your mind around what is that something? What does it even mean to talk about the flow of time, or, you know, our perception, and why does that perception seem to change during different times, right? You can see I'm using this word time in so many different senses, but we can all intuitively understand what I mean by each version of it. But in this episode, we're going to be talking about a bunch of different strange things about time and the brain and our illusions that arise about time, just the perception of time itself, the way that the brain calculates, measures, keeps track of time. And it's just, this is kind of a mind-blowing subject in my opinion. So I'm excited to get into it. Welcome to The Social Brain. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Taylor. And this is a show where we dive into how the brain works. If you've ever wondered what's going on inside your mind, even the things that you're not even aware of, then this is the place where we can unpack that and really explore it.
Yeah, so as Andrew was just hinting, like, this has been one of the most mind-blowing episodes I think I've done research for. Like, really wrapping your head around how weird time in the brain actually is. I mean, the fact that all of our senses travel at different speeds, but we still have this like unified perception of everything happening at the same time and in sync and all of these things. Like, it's wacky how all of this stuff works. I mean, the fact that we don't see our eyes moving when we look in the mirror and like all of this stuff, that's just, it's really, really cool. So we're going to get into kind of our subjective sense of time. We'll touch on some of the like, the physics. That stuff is a little bit outside of our wheelhouse and is honestly,
it's completely,
unless you're traveling at the speed of light, like it doesn't really come into play. But really getting into kind of how the brain constructs this sense of time and how it seems to move slow sometimes and fast in others, and how memories entwined and all of this stuff. It's really cool.
Yeah, it is wild. Like you said, it's been so fascinating to learn about it. And just the fact that, you know, you can think back on an experience and try to reconstruct how much time it took, right? And this is kind of the first thing we're going to get into, because I think a lot of people, I think I've had this experience. It's kind of hard. This is what we'll get into, what exactly this means. But where if you're having a really, you're in a dangerous situation or kind of like a, maybe even traumatic or something that's really, really intense, where you're in physical danger, especially, many people report this, like when looking back on that event, that it seemed to, like time itself seemed to slow down. The passage of events unfolding was slower. But we're going to get into whether that's really an accurate description or how we can even understand that. Like a personal story, I remember years ago, it was Christmas Eve 2019. and I was skiing by myself. I had just gotten my skis waxed and they were super fast because of that. So I was just like ripping down these slopes and I just lost control and flew into the forest, right? Just right next to the slope, and completely lost control. And I remember in that moment just thinking like, oh no, something bad is about to happen. And then slamming into a tree and breaking a rib. I think when I look back on that, it does seem like there was kind of something about that event that seemed slowed down, right? Because it probably only took like couple seconds maybe, but it seems longer now looking back on it. But now that we're like, let's get into this, because what I've learned about these kinds of things makes me question whether that's just a product of my memory, if it's an illusion, or if it's something real.
Yeah, can our brain slow down time? I mean, you even have this reported from like baseball players that are able to hit a fastball going over 90 miles an hour, right? Are they really kind of slowing down time to be able to see that ball and hit it? I've had a similar experience. I was in a car accident on the freeway in Las Vegas. These cars all stopped in front of me and I swerved, and all of a sudden my car started spinning across all four lanes of this huge highway. And like, luckily I didn't hit anything. I didn't get hit by a semi or anything like that. But I remember seeing the details of like all of these things and like feeling like I was spinning. But the whole thing, like you said, was like a couple of seconds. And there's actually researchers that have looked into this idea. David Eagleman being one of like my favorite researchers just in general. His books are fantastic. But he has this similar story that when he was young, he fell off a roof. And he felt like that whole thing, like Alice in Wonderland, like falling down the rabbit hole, right? That it was just this really long adventure down to the bottom and you could see all the bricks and all the detail. And then he talks about being in physics, because that was when he was a kid, and he talks about calculating the actual time of the fall later, and that it was like less than a second. And so he then spent a bunch of his career like trying to understand time and whether we were really actually seeing in slow motion.
Yeah, and he kind of recreated almost that childhood experience in a future experiment that he did called, I can't remember exactly what it was called, but the basic setup was you had people fall from a really high height, right? So it's to give people this danger, this, you know, extremely scary terrifying experience. Yeah, terrifying, where they fall. I don't remember how high it is, but it's
three
high
stories.
Three yeah stories, and they mm-hmm fall down and land in this giant net. And the backwards net catch backwards. Yeah, so they're looking up as they're falling, and they land in the net backwards. They don't even know, you know, when they're going to hit that net. And the idea was like, okay, induce this kind of danger, this dangerous experience, this like super emotionally charged, scary experience, and see if people report it as seeming like it was slower, like time slowed down, and then try to measure whether they were actually perceiving events or if time actually was seeming to slow down in their perception of it. And the way they did this was super clever. He had this device that was kind of like a digital screen. And I can't remember, were they holding it when they were?
It was
on
there. It was like a watch. It was a wristband.
It was a watch. So they're looking at it as they're falling. And it's basically displaying, like to simplify it, it's displaying these digits really, really fast in a way that if you were looking at it just sitting here, you'd have no idea what digit it's actually displaying. It would just look like random
back and
mash.
Forth.
Yeah, yep. Back and forth of lights. But then if you could actually slow down time, right? If your brain was perceiving, time more slowly, if the passage of those events were seeming to go by slower, then you would be able to see what digits were appearing on the screen. But that's not what happened. People weren't able to figure out what the digits were. So the idea was like, even though it feels like when you look back on it, that time is slowing down, that might just be, that seems to be from this experiment, just an illusion.
This is one of the most fascinating neuroscience experiments that I think has ever been done. Like, we're going to push people off a tower backwards, like three stories, and just terrify them to see if the brain slows down time. And one of the things they did too is they had people down at the bottom watching people fall and estimating like how long that fall actually took. And they had like stopwatches and everything. And then they had the people that actually did the fall after. They gave them a stopwatch and they said, all right, I want you to close your eyes and I want you to put yourself back in that scenario and fall and like tell me how long that actually was. And they ended up, it was going for like 13 seconds before a lot of them were embarrassed. And they were like, it actually felt longer than that. But like, I felt embarrassed because I know that it wasn't, right? And so you have this kind of retrospective memory after the fact of looking back on it and it feeling like so much longer than it actually was. But in the moment, like Andrew said, they had this like watch on and they weren't actually seeing time in slow motion, or else they would have been able to see the numbers flashing back and forth on this watch. And so he really dug into this and he's just like, what is this? Is this some kind of memory trick?
Yeah. And his kind of conclusion from that was that it was a memory trick, and it was the result, at least his interpretation was the result of, so basically your amygdala, your the part of your brain that kind of triggers your fight or flight response and is really important for emotional memories, and especially important in dangerous and threatening situations, that is, you know, firing like crazy when you're falling backwards. And it is, in a sense, like your brain is forming really what he called really dense memories, really emotionally dense memories. So it's like there's more information, more stuff getting into your memory during that short period of time, so that when you look back on it, compared to all your other memories, it seems like a ton of stuff happened during that time. And so you look back on this thing, oh, well, you know, more time must have passed. Like time must have been going slowly, or almost that's kind of what your brain is doing, making you think that time slowed down.
And I think this is going to be a really common thread through all of this, that our perception of time is so linked to salience, right? Something that's like really important, like in this case for survival, right? There's this terrifying thing happening to us. And so all of a sudden our brain is now laying down a ton of memories because it's like, oh, this is life threatening. I need to remember what to do in this situation in the future. And so it's just recording everything. And so when you look back on that memory, you have so many more events that were clocked that now it feels like a much longer kind of period of time. And you can kind of, there's this really wacky kind of thing that happens with time where, let's say you're like sitting at the airport and you have like a delayed flight. That feels like so long that you're sitting there and there's just like nothing to do. I mean, we have like phones now, you watch videos, but you're just like, you're just bored, right? You're just like sitting around and it feels like that takes forever. But the trip that you were just on, you were doing all this fun stuff and time seemed to have gone really fast. Your 10-day vacation is like over all of a sudden, right? But when you look back on it, the time at the airport is like a blip, even though it felt really long while you were there. But then your vacation feels really long because there was all these novel things that you were doing. And so when you look back on it, and so it really kind of demonstrates this really intimate tie between our perception of time and our memory of the events that we have. And that the more novel things that happen, the more salient, the more emotionally charged things that happen, the more we kind of view it as being a longer period of time.
Yeah. And as we'll get into later, this kind of makes a lot of sense in light of the neuroscience of time, what we understand from it, at least, that there's not one master clock in the brain that is, you know, just ticking off time. And if that slows down, then your perception of time slows down. That's not what it's like. It's really that there's this distributed system of many different neural clocks, so to speak, in different areas of the brain that are measuring different kind of scales of time. And we'll get into that later, but it does make sense that it would be hard to imagine how that sort of system would just all slow down all at once. But anyway, we'll get into that a little bit more. I think the main point of this, though, is something that both David Eagleman and Dean Buonomano, who wrote this book, Your Brain is a Time Machine. He's one of the leading neuroscientists studying time. And he and Eagleman both emphasize this point that it's time, the perception of time, like everything else, like your perception of space and everything else, is a construction of your brain. That your brain is actively constructing this perception of things unfolding at a certain speed, whatever that means. Yeah. Right. And that's when it starts tapping into, well, what is consciousness? And I don't want to go too far afield, but just want to emphasize that point.
And that's a big thing that's hanging over our heads this whole episode, is that like, we don't know what consciousness is. And a lot of consciousness researchers are in the field of our kind of conscious experience being an active construction of the brain, that it's not really what's out there. It's our best guess at what's out there. It's our prediction of maybe what's going to happen next and all of these things. And so much of what we do in this world depends on the speed at which our survival needs are dependent on, right? Like, we see at a certain time interval because that's the speed that like animals that we need to catch move. And that's the speed that the sun traverses through the sky and all of these things that we've entrained ourselves to. Right? We're on these kind of circadian rhythms throughout the day. We're on these circannual rhythms throughout the year. Like all of these things that have been timed to actual physical phenomena in the world. And that's something that's really important when you think about time. And I mean, this comes back to, I think it was a quote from Einstein, that like any repetitive kind of physical phenomenon can serve as a clock, right? Even like raindrops falling is something that Buonomano like mentions, is that like there's a certain frequency that they're falling. And if you use that, then that's your time interval. But we use kind of the pendulation of quartz crystals or of an actual pendulum, something that is kind of symmetrical and rhythmic, has a sine wave. And that's how we mark, like, okay, these are seconds, these are minutes, right? But all of that is a construction of us. And like, and it's something that we're about to get into that gets really, really funky when you start looking at how we live in the past.
Yeah, that is fascinating. I want to get to that. And I want to emphasize, like, just on that point you just made, that the active construction of time, well, maybe, I mean, it's possible that it really is, that there really is a flow of time that we're perceiving. But what we're emphasizing here is that like we were just talking about, your perception of how quickly or slowly that is going, like, what is the rate of time, which is kind of like a weird circular contradictory question already, but whatever that means, like, the fact that it can change based on our experiences seems to indicate that, like, we're not perceiving it in a fully kind of objective way. But yeah, as you were just talking about, one of the other strange things about the perception of time is that it takes time for a signal, for example, vision, if photons hit your eye, right? It takes time for the cells in your retina to transmit that signal to your brain, to get to your visual cortex, for you to actually see what's out in front of you. And then, so that just by itself means, right, that we're not perceiving the present moment in that kind of like objective sense, because it takes that time for the light to hit our eyes and make its way into our brain.
Like, where is right now in the brain? It doesn't make sense. The question doesn't make sense at all. And it gets back to what you were just getting at with this idea of, like, there's no one just kind of master clock in the brain. There's no just like ticking quartz crystal in our brain that's like second, second, second. That we actually have multiple different types of clocks that are used for different types of events and things like that. And that's why it feels longer sometimes and shorter in others. But it's all tied to this fact that our senses are moving at different speeds. They actually did an experiment where they had something that was able to take like 7 trillion frames per second to try to map out the speed at which a signal actually traversed across like a neuron from like touch signals. And they calculated it at 75 meters per second, which is actually slower than the dive of a peregrine falcon, the fastest animal on Earth, right? And so it shows you that there's actually a time lag. Like, if you pick something up, like if I pick up this water bottle, I'm actually feeling it 100 milliseconds after it was already in my hand, right? It takes time for that signal to get all the way up to my brain, for me to make sense of what that thing is that I just touched, right? And then to also connect that with the signals that are coming from the other senses. And sight moves quicker than sound, moves quicker than touch, right? And there's all of these different things that are all happening at the same time at different speeds. And then our brain has to kind of wait for all of them to come up before it constructs our conscious experience. And so and this is what I was hinting at, we live in the past. And researchers think that we live about a half second in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. And the estimates can vary on exactly what that, how long in the past we're living and all that. But it's, that point about the brain having to like bind all this together and then make it seem like it's all happening simultaneously. Well, it is, like, it's happening simultaneously out in the world, right? If I snap my fingers and you see that and hear that at the same time, and I feel it all at the same time, that is all happening at once, right? But it's what Taylor's saying is it's reaching the various signals are reaching my brain at different speeds. So the sight the light from my hand is hitting my eyes faster than the sound is reaching my ears, faster than the signal traveling down my arm from the touch sensation is reaching my brain. And then there's even more complications with it, where I was just reading that the auditory system is actually faster at transmitting signals to the brain than the visual system. But of course, light travels faster than sound. So like all this gets pretty complicated. But the point we're making here is, like Taylor said, we might live about, you know, a half a second or so in the past based on what we're just talking about.
So there's a little bit of nuance to what you just said, right? it's not necessarily that sound travels faster than sight. It's that our body can respond to sound faster than sight. That the sight signals actually do move quicker. And they've actually, so they've done these experiments with like runners off the block, right? Where you have a flash of light that is like an indication like go, or there's the gun, right? And the gun actually travels to the brain slower. And so you'd expect them to start later with the gun than with the flash of light. But the brain, the unconscious brain, can actually respond to sound faster. It's the conscious part that's slower. Right? It's the construction of like, what is that thing? But that kind of makes sense survival-wise, right? If I'm seeing something dangerous, that's probably at a bit of a distance. But if I hear something dangerous, it's probably right next to me and I need to move right now before I've been able to see it and identify it or whatever it is. And like, people can probably relate to that, right? I just like hit this thing behind me and it like, it gave me a jump, right? There's a survival aspect to that. And it really paints this picture. I mean, we've talked about it on the show before that, you know, most consciousness researchers believe that only 2% of what our brain does is actually something that we're aware of. Right. And so we have all of this stuff that's making sense of these signals before it's kind of brought to this like delayed consciousness thing that we have.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. That's a good clarification. But yeah, there's all these ways that we like we're talking about these different processing times. And there's so many different ways that our brain can be influenced to perceive time in a different way. And one interesting thing is like the impact that various neurotransmitters have on our experience of time. So things like dopamine and serotonin and cannabinoids. I mean, just as an aside, before we get into dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin, if you've ever, if you're in a place where it's legal and you've ever used marijuana or THC specifically, you may have noticed that it's kind of seems like time is distorted in some way, that maybe time is slowing down. And there's some really interesting studies on this, but, you know, just pointing to the fact that activating and increasing the activation of like, in this case, the endocannabinoid system can change how we're perceiving the unfolding of events in terms of like how quickly they're happening. But probably the more solid research has to do with dopamine. So do you want to speak to that?
Yeah. So there's this really interesting, like if you inject someone with something that increases dopamine in the brain, they actually report that time is kind of moving kind of, I don't want to say slower. So they overestimate time. Right. And so they think that like more time is happening, right? So they're like, they're in it, right? It's kind of like what we were talking about earlier with like the traumatic events. Like when dopamine is high, you seem to be slicing time more finely. And so it seems like more time has elapsed. So if you tell them to like clock a minute without a watch or without any type of stopwatch, just like tell me when a minute has happened. They tend to overestimate that minute. That they think that it's lasted a lot longer than it actually has. And this is really beneficial. And it makes sense kind of in terms of like evolution and like what these neurotransmitters are actually for, right? Dopamine, like we've talked about tons on this show, is really about kind of motivation. It's about actively like being in the world doing something, right? And if you're engaged with the world, if you're manipulating things, if you're kind of solving these hard problems, then it makes sense to have kind of a more detailed description of what you're doing, right? But then I think Andrew kind of hinted at, and he can kind of get into the other side of this, that we see kind of the opposite with serotonin.
Yeah, with endocannabinoids. One interesting thing though, like this kind of gets into the prospective versus retrospective timing, because I think when people are doing the task you mentioned of trying to estimate how much like when a minute has passed by after being injected with some kind of dopamine agonist, I think they overestimate that like it's been a minute when it's actually only been 50 seconds. And actually I think this more gets into just the terms that we're using to describe this stuff can get really, really confusing really quickly. And that just has to do with are you taking the standard of time? Like, is it an internal reference, or are you talking about the time that has passed outside? But I just wanted to clarify that, because like right when you said, I was like, but no, you're completely right. Yeah, people do overestimate how much time has passed. Yeah, completely correct. But getting back to serotonin, it seems like there's at least some research that says that people tend to underestimate the amount of time that's passed at high levels of serotonin, right? Yeah. And so this idea that it's kind of slowing these frame rates, like Taylor's saying, instead of finely slicing them, you're slicing bigger chunks of time as being what, like a moment or a second or whatever it might be. Again, this does get into, are we talking about when you're looking back on it, or is this really happening in real time? And that's a tough question to answer.
And it's interesting. If any of you have watched like the Huberman episode about time and all of that, he actually advocates for the fact that we can see in slow motion when dopamine is high, that we are seeing in slow motion. And this is something that we were trying to get at in the beginning in terms of like these experiments with David Eagleman were saying the exact opposite, that like when you get in a car crash, you're not actually hearing the person next to you go, no, right? You're just recording more information. And so when you look back on it, it seems like a lot more time has actually passed. But what we think is happening is that we are actually kind of slicing time more finely. We have a higher frame rate, right? So like you can play things in slow motion. If you have a high frame rate camera, then if you play that high frame rate and you play it as the like each of those at a slower rate, then it looks like everything was moving in slow motion. But while you were taking those frames, time wasn't actually moving slower, right? You were just collecting more information, right? And then you can do something with it later. You can look back on it, you can slow it down, and you can actually like see it in your mind as being slower. But I haven't seen any convincing evidence that we're actually slowing time down. And like, there's the case of like the baseball player that I mentioned earlier, that there's a lot of automaticity that happens with swinging that bat over and over and over and over again, where we talked about there's unconscious components to this and there's conscious components. So our subjective kind of feeling of time might be a lot different than the body's ability to react to something in a certain amount of time.
Yeah, that's a really great point. It's kind of hard to even imagine like how you would in the moment test how quickly time is passing, other than the experiment we talked about with David Eagleman. Yeah. But even that, it's clever. People looking back on it in some way. Like right now, you could ask yourself, like, how fast is time passing? What's the speed of, does it seem like it's passing slowly or quickly? And I don't really, to me, that doesn't even seem like a really meaningful question. Like I'm trying to even just answer it for myself. And I, you know, well, with Taylor here, of course, time is just dragging on. It just feels like I'm just being, you know, bored out of my mind. No, but it is strange. I mean, there are times I will say there's some research on how cognitive load. So like how challenging basically a task is cognitively can affect your perception of time, and how that can change whether you're, so there's these experiments where people are basically told to sort cards into piles. And the control group is just taking one card off the deck and just placing it into a single pile. They're just doing, I mean, that's mindless, right? There's nothing to that. But the other group is sorting it according to suit. So that's a little bit higher cognitive load, a little bit more difficult. Yeah. And what they find is when they ask people after doing that task to look back on how long they think it took, the people in the high cognitive load situation thought that it was a shorter interval, right? Like, so, and you can kind of think like, if you're in a test, if you're taking a test in school or something, sometimes it's like the clock just seems like it's going so fast, especially if it's a really difficult test and you're like, oh, I only have 5 minutes left. I can't believe this. Whereas you're in that same classroom during a boring lecture, you know, not when Taylor's teaching you, when someone else is teaching you, and it just feels like it's dragging on. So there's all these factors, cognitive load, paradoxes, dopamine, you know, the level of danger you're experiencing that changes your perception of time.
And something interesting I wanted to bring up with dopamine too, is that one of the main kind of themes that I mentioned earlier was this idea of salience, of novelty, right? That our perception of time seems to be really, really linked to this idea of like important things happening. And dopamine is incredibly linked to that, right? That when we have surprising, novel, exciting things happening, that's when we're having these big kind of phasic releases of dopamine, like these just kind of hits of dopamine, like, oh, whoa, that was something. And they think that there's this like really intimate tie to dopamine and memory, right? That when you have these kind of big hits of dopamine, it's actually tagging those things in the environment as being important predictors of that surprising thing, right? There's a reason why when you see the Starbucks logo, you get a craving for Starbucks. And that's because you had something that was really tasty, and dopamine kind of clocked all of these things as being important predictors of leading to the coffee, right? And it's kind of the same thing. It's tying all of these novel, kind of exciting, whatever things to kind of memories that end up becoming more and more dense, right? And this is really kind of linked to this idea of there's been a lot of reports, and I mean, I can speak to it, of time moving really fast when you're young and moving really slow when you're old, right? And it's really kind of connected to these ideas, right? When you're young, I mean, my son, he's, everything is new to him. He's trying things. He's out there having fun, doing whatever, being imaginative. And then when you're older, like me, and you're just boring and like you do the same thing every day, right?
Same podcast every week.
Right? Right? time just blows by, right? And it seems like there's just like nothing happening. And it's because you're not clocking as many novel things.
And it's strange because like, as you're saying that, I was thinking about, well, also though, when I was young, and I guess this is actually completely in line with what you're saying. When you're young, like a year, you know, I remember being a teenager and thinking like a year was this a very long time, because like, right. Part of that might just be like, it's a large proportion of your life up to that point. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a 1 year is a yeah. higher percentage of your life than when you're, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 or 60, like it progressively gets smaller and smaller. And a year like seems to pass much more quickly. But also exactly what Taylor's talking about, as you get older, you get into more of a routine. You get into, yeah. you're not like every year, you're not in a new grade and having new experiences and blah, blah, all these crazy different things that happen when you're young. It gets a little bit more routine. And so time, looking back on it, seems like it's passing faster. Again, yeah, I'm getting this
right, and there's paradoxes with this, because yeah. subjective in the moment time is different than reflective time, and I look at like, so my son is 4 years old now, right? And high school was 4 years, and the 4 years of him being a little kid went by like that compared to like, oh my God, I got to be in high school for 4 years, right? I mean, I tell like new undergrads that I've been in grad school for 7 years, and they're like, oh my God, 7 years, that's like forever. And it feels like I started like 6 months ago, right? I mean, it's just because there's so much repetitive stuff, routine stuff, and not even, because like there are paradoxes with this, right? Because like there is still a lot of novelty in what I do. Like I am researching kind of new things. I'm reading new articles. I'm learning new stuff about the brain every week as we prepare for this podcast, right? But I think that there's something to do with like the kind of salience, the kind of novelty, that like this stuff is more for just like self-actualization of like making myself better. But I think the things that really lay down those like long memory things are things that are just like so different and so just like life-threatening, or like I'm in a completely different environment because I'm coming back to the same house over and over and over again. Like I'm doing new things, but the whole environment is really similar, right?
Yeah. And this kind of gets back to our episode on adolescence, where mm-hmm. The theory that seems most compelling to me and seems to fit the evidence is that adolescence is really this period for gathering new experiences. Yeah. So during that, you know, not young adulthood, but pre-adulthood, right? Where you're, yeah. you're before you're like 20 something, you're gathering, like your brain is really set up in a lot of ways, physiologically, psychologically, to take in and gather more experiences, and especially novel experiences and yep. novelty seeking peaks in adolescence, and all of these things that we're talking about, you know, novelty seeking associated with dopamine and these novel experiences.
Dopamine.
Yeah, exactly. So it does make sense in the light of that developmental stuff as well.
And that was something I brought up in the adolescence episode, is that like, I remember more of what happened when I was like 16 to 20 than I remember what I had for breakfast yesterday, right? Like there's so much more dense memory during that time. And a lot of it was because we were laying down memory to be able to survive later, right? And it's this stuff that's really tied to kind of personal need and personal kind of like, how do I go out in the world and kind of be a functioning member of society and learning those skills? All of this stuff just kind of, it blows your mind. And
it does.
I think one of the things that I really wanted to get to too was, and I think that we have it on here. So, is this idea of not having a master clock, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this goes back to, phrenology. If anybody knows what phrenology is, that was like, 1800s, where they thought there was like a specific part of the brain for every kind of mental faculty that we have. And when you look at the pictures of like phrenology of the thing, the brain split into like the nice region and the music region and like all of these things, there's a region that they identified that like, this is the clock. This is what's keeping time. And when you really look at the temporal dynamics in the brain, there is so many different types of clocks. And that is fascinating that we'll kind of get into here now. One of these really cool things is there are new techniques now for kind of studying MRI data. And there's this one of my kind of like idols in the neuroscience world is a man named Uri Hasan. That discovered what are called temporal receptive windows. This is like one of the most fascinating kind of new discoveries about the brain. We knew for a long time that there were spatial receptive windows, that there were certain cells like in the visual cortex that would respond to specific areas of space, right? But he's starting to show that there are kind of different types of kind of time receptive windows where, let me put this into perspective, right? So he has this really good quote that he says, you know, the present contains nothing but the past. And that's kind of what we've been getting at, right? Like we live in the past. You have to wait for a signal to get from your toe to your brain. If you touch your nose and your toe at the same time, you feel those happen at the same time. But that's impossible, right? Because the signal from your toe took a long time to get to your brain, and your brain had to just wait for all of that stuff to happen, right? And so what his idea was he said, let's look at if there's different parts of the brain that are sensitive to different kind of portions of the past, different lengths of the past, right? And what he discovered, so he did this really clever controlled experiment where he had this whole narrative. It was kind of like a comedy skit that had been done, like someone on stage. And he had people in the MRI scanner that were listening to this. And what he did was first he kind of scrambled the whole thing so that all they were hearing was just like random sounds or random words. And what he found was that you have, when it's just random nonsense, random words, the auditory cortex, the part of our brain that's actually processing sound, is really kind of lined up between people. And that means that part of the brain is processing information really quickly. It's processing information right now. So like there's a sound happening, that part of the brain is processing that sound. But now he had a different condition where instead of just kind of random sounds, now he has like full words or full sentences or full paragraphs. And what he starts to see is that there's this spread from the auditory cortex along what's called the superior temporal sulcus, which is kind of the auditory cortex and the temporal lobe back to the back, and then up into the default mode network that we've talked about, where each of these different regions is kind of receptive to a longer period of time, right? You have the first part of the brain, the auditory cortex, is just processing things on the millisecond. Kind of, it's like, here's this sound, here's this sound, here's this sound, here's this sound. But then it's then passing those sounds to the next brain region that's clocking the sound right now, but also putting it together with the sound that happened right before it. And in order to hear a word, you have to put those two sounds together, right? And so now you have a word. But then that region is now passing something to the next one, which is now receptive to a longer period of time, where it's not just receptive to one word, it's now receptive to a whole sentence, right? It's able to keep track of all of the words that have happened in the last 2 or 3 seconds and put them all together, make sure that there's noun-verb agreement, that the sentence makes sense, right? And then you get higher and higher up the cortical hierarchy, and now you have regions that are sensitive to really long periods of time, right? The reason that I'm able to use a pronoun like he or she is because I identified he or she as Bob or Sally like 10 seconds ago, right? And so you have a part of your brain that is now keeping track of all of this stuff that's happened across time and integrating it with what's happening right now. And you get to the default mode network, and the default mode network is believed to be able to integrate across really long periods of time. And then connected with like the hippocampus can integrate stuff over years, over decades, right? That we can hear something that's happening right now. You're listening to this conversation that we're having about time. And you're also integrating that with all of the things that you've learned about psychology, about the brain, about time in general, and all of these things are all kind of getting mashed together. And that's because there are different parts of your brain that are sensitive to different time bins, different kind of lengths of time. And so it kind of speaks to this idea that we were talking about with like, there is no master clock. There are different parts of our brain that are operating on incredibly different timescales. And we think that consciousness is kind of at the top of that hierarchy. So we're experiencing something that has taken time to integrate all of this stuff and then form this nice kind of narrative, this nice picture for us to kind of experience of the world.
Yeah. And that links up to also what we were talking about earlier about how our brain is in some ways kind of in this metaphorical sense, or maybe even literal, that we're living in the past in some way. But yeah, one way for people to kind of wrap their mind around what Taylor was just saying is Dean Bonomano, I would say his name wrong. He offered this interesting thing. So I'll say it. So I'm going to say two sentences. The mouse broke, or the mouse died, right? So those sentences are almost identical except for the last word, right? And yet you perceive the meaning of those sentences differently. It's not like as I'm saying it, you're hearing me say the mouse broke or the mouse died. It's not like you're perceiving the meaning of each individual word. Yeah. You're perceiving the meaning of that sentence as a whole. So you have to wait until I get to the end of the sentence to actually understand what the meaning of what I was just saying is, because the mouse broke, right? I'm referring to a mouse for a computer, right? Versus the mouse died, I'm referring to an animal. And you're not perceiving this construction process that Taylor was kind of just hinting at. And that's happening under the surface, and then it's being broadcast into consciousness.
And I mean, this is fascinating, right? Because it's really talking about this idea that the brain is kind of waiting to really cook up this explanation to you as the person that's aware of what's really going on. And that takes time, right? They've talked about like tall people live further in the past than short people because it takes longer for the signal to get from their toe up to their brain or whatever. But you have these integrative windows, and there's this really interesting, we were going to mention it earlier, I think it's really kind of effective right here, is the flash lag effect. Mm-hmm. And I wish I could show it to you because it's really nice to be able to see it. But the idea is that there's like a green circle. And if you're watching this, I just have like a circle with my hand, right? So the circle is kind of going around in a circle, and there's a point where a flash happens inside the circle. But you actually see the flash happen behind the circle. And it's this idea, like, and they've been trying to figure out like why, even though it's happening, even though the information that the actual light is hitting our retina with the light in the circle, our perception is different, right? We've constructed this different kind of view of reality based on kind of us predicting certain things. Well, David Eagleman did another version of this, because a lot of people were like, well, it's all about prediction. It's that we think that the circle is going to continue going. And so we see the flash behind where it's going, right? But he did this other one where instead of it going in the same direction, it goes and it stops and it goes in the other direction, or it goes and stops and stays there, or it kind of does this other thing. The idea that he came to with all of this, and again, I wish I could show this all to you, but was that you would expect if it's going around in a circle and then it stops and changes direction, your brain is supposed to think that it's going to continue traveling in the same direction. So you should see the flash behind it in a certain direction, but we don't. Main idea behind all of this is that we are waiting to see what happens next. And that's what we're using to kind of construct and fill things back in. And so that half second that it takes for us to really kind of put all these things together is then used to reconstruct this perception that we're having. And that was I know that was pretty convoluted. I'm sorry. Look up the illusion if you want to. Andrew might have a better explanation.
No, it's good. I mean, I do have one pulled up that I could try sharing, see if it it shows. Let's see if this works. So you're supposed to fixate on that cross, that X in the middle, and then see what you perceive with the circle going around.
It sounds a little jumpy. Maybe it's
It's probably probably not going to work. Anyway, I'll stop sharing it. But people can look that up. The flash lag illusion. It's exactly what really Taylor cool. was just saying. Yeah.
And I mean, it's more to say about like this construction process, right? Is the fact that I don't know if many of you realize that you actually delete about 4 minutes of your visual life every day, and over an 80-year life, you've deleted 2 years of your life of visual information. And that happens every time you do a saccade, every time your eyes move. So this is one of the most kind of fascinating experiments that you can do on yourself, right? Go look in the mirror and look back and forth from one eye to the other, and you'll never see your eyes move. But if you watch someone else do it, you see their eyes move, right? You see them going back and forth as they look from one eye to the other. And it's because of the fact that if I was actually displaying that visual information while my eyes were moving, and they move like 3 to 4 times a second, then my view of the world would be really jumpy, right? It's like walking around with your camera and it's like all over the place, right? And so the brain actually deletes all of that information and then backfills it with stuff that looks like it's flowing in time. You also see this if you're looking at a clock and you look away and then look back, it doesn't look like the hand actually moved. It's kind of the clock lag effect. But it's just kind of, it all kind of paints this the same picture that our kind of reality, our conscious experience is a construction of the brain to try to make sense of what's important to us.
Yeah, no, that was funny. You lagged for a second, and all I heard was right when you got back, is it lag effect? So, anyway, that's an aside. And so, yeah, and I think we've kind of like hammered on that point quite a lot. Yeah. And one of the, I think, something I hinted at earlier about the neuroscience of time and timing in the brain is what Taylor talked about it when he was mentioning phrenology, that there kind of used to be this thought that the brain had a single master clock that was ticking off, you know, every time scale you can imagine, from, you know, milliseconds all the way up to years or days or whatever it might be. But that really doesn't seem to be the case. And one interesting finding that I've read about is that there's no brain region that when it's damaged has been shown to completely obliterate people's perception of time. There are definitely brain damage that can obscure, can mess with certain aspects of time perception, like you know, damage to the memory system in the brain can make it hard or even impossible for some people to think about the future or to estimate how much time has passed from yesterday because they can't remember it, or these kinds of things. But so when it, what is really the how does the brain really do this kind of timing? And as Taylor's mentioning, there's kind of the more cognitive side of it when we're talking about perceiving sounds or sights or those kinds of things, and how you have these different temporal processing windows. But when you get down to how does the brain time, you know, for example, like if I'm going to time, how long does it take for me between like these two snaps of my fingers, right? Yeah. What is my brain doing when I estimate how much time is going on there? And that's a really thorny, like difficult question. And one of the reasons is that it seems that timing, the ability to time, is built into the kind of the very structure of neural circuits. And there's some really interesting work on how they've like determined this, but basically like neurons in really common kinds of circuits in the brain can have this sort of intrinsic timing that can be scaled up, right, into large populations of neurons, and have this kind of effect where it takes a certain amount of time for a neural signal to, for example, travel along the axon of a neuron. And that can have an effect on the postsynaptic neuron, but only if it happens within a certain amount of time, right? If it gets a number of signals within a certain amount of time. And that can be, that's just one example of a sort of a picture of the intrinsic nature of timing in the brain.
And I think something that's really important that we haven't mentioned yet that's kind of tied to that idea is that we have to think about how the brain is syncing these things up, right? That there are these signals that are happening from sound, from sight, from all of these things. How does the brain know how to put them together in time? And a lot of it, what people think, has to do with cause and effect. That it's me moving through the world. It's me interacting with the world. I know that if I put a motor movement out and touch something, that I'm the one that caused that thing to move. And so that touch, the sound, the sight of all of those things moving had to have happened simultaneously, because I know that I'm the one that caused that cause and effect reaction to happen. And so we think that the way that the brain kind of allows for this kind of synchronization to happen across our senses and across these different firing rates and all of these things is really about interacting with the world. And this is like what babies do, right? They go and they touch things and they make sounds and they do all of these things, and they're the ones that are manipulating the world. When someone else is doing something, we have no idea whether that should be synced up or not. But if we put that motor movement out and get sensory signals back, then we know for a fact that like we started this at that time. And there was a really interesting experiment that kind of demonstrated this. It was another Eagleman experiment that was really cool, where they had these people, they push a button and they introduced a kind of lag. It was like 100 milliseconds, then they would flash a light. So they push a button. And what happens is that lag is not very big. And so the brain starts to kind of reduce that distance, and it starts to actually feel like you're doing it simultaneously. You're pushing the button and the light's happening at the same time. But then they pull a trick on you where they actually move the light to happen at the exact same time you push the button. And then people report seeing the light before they push the button. And so it kind of demonstrates this idea that our brain is constantly adjusting to the timing based on how we're interacting with the world, the signals that we're getting back, right? He gives examples of like at dusk when the light is getting low, you have this different speed in visual processing that's now not linked up with your motor movements. And so if you throw someone a ball in a dim light, they'll actually miss it because they're not synced up, because things have started moving at a different speed. But then you give them enough time and the brain starts to adapt to it because they've started to kind of manipulate and experiment with those cause and effect relationships.
Yeah, that is fascinating. And as we move through the time scales, right, we have to kind of acknowledge that there's these much longer time scales that we perceive as well, because pretty much everything we've been talking about in this episode is like looking back on an experience that took maybe, you know, a few minutes at most. Yeah. But of course, like we all know that there's some kind of timing built into our brain when we talk about like circadian rhythms, right? Because you are more, just on the most basic level, more alert at certain times of day than others. And it's really a predictable rhythm that can happen. You fall asleep, you wake up, probably for a lot of people, definitely for me, I just have so much trouble trying to fall asleep even just a couple hours before my usual bedtime, right? So There's something built into our brain that is kind of these molecular clocks that allow us to have these circadian rhythms that kind of trigger us into different kind of states at different times. And this is really different than the sort of timing that we've been talking about throughout this episode, but I think it's still important to acknowledge that we have these longer time scales that our brain is sensitive to as well.
Yeah. I mean, my alarm clock doesn't have a snooze button, right? My 4-year-old wakes up at 7 o'clock every single morning, right? And it's just something that's like, he's entrained to it, right? And there's also like, there's genes in our cells called clock genes that are kind of tuned to 24-hour cycles. There's circannual rhythms because of the way that the light is getting less and less throughout the year that affects our melatonin levels, that makes us sleepy at different times and all of these things. So like our body is entrained to the environment. And when you deprive people of sunlight or anything like that, their time perception in general gets thrown off. Their ability to kind of estimate how much time has passed and how much hasn't, all of these things. And so that's a really important point that Andrew's making, is that like we are entraining to whatever our environment is, however fast things are moving, whatever the light levels are, what time we're eating and going to sleep every day. Those are things that are then getting kind of stamped down in our biology that then kind of work on this kind of cyclical rhythm. And there's so many things that are cyclical. There's like depressive symptoms that are cyclical. There's like all of these kind of mental health things that seem to go on these kind of rhythms. Like there's a ton of stuff that we don't understand yet about how these things kind of keep track of time.
Yeah. And one interesting thing we've talked about in the past, when we talked about sleep and why do you feel more and more tired throughout the day and then eventually fall asleep mm-hmm. at a certain time at night? And this is just one example of like a circadian rhythm, kind of to yep. give people an idea of the mechanism that we're talking about. It yep. can differ in different cases, but in this case, one of the things that's happening is researchers refer to this as like sleep pressure. So the like basically how sleepy you are throughout the day, we can conceptualize it that way. And one thing that's happening is that there's this neurotransmitter called adenosine. And adenosine is really involved in brain regions that are involved in putting you to sleep. It's really important for activating those brain regions. And throughout the day, adenosine levels build up in your brain. Yep. They get big, higher and higher throughout the day, so that like by the time you're going to sleep, adenosine is at its peak and is putting you to sleep basically. And then it goes down and you wake up in the morning and you've got less adenosine, right? And caffeine works on the adenosine system. It blocks that, that interaction. So that's why caffeine is so bad for sleep, but so good at waking up in the morning. So that's just like one example of one of these sort of biochemical mechanisms that's happening.
And I think kind of as we get to the end of the episode, one of the things that I really wanted to kind of highlight is the incredible capacity that the human brain has for time, for perceiving time, for manipulating time at a mental level. Like we have the ability to simulate time. We have the ability to time travel in our mind, right? And it's because we have this incredible capacity to link cause and effect relationships over these long periods of time, right? Time is the most common word in the English vocabulary, right? We've said it like 1,000 times this episode, time, right? But because of this fact that we're able to integrate over longer and longer periods, right? The default mode network and all of these things and bringing in the hippocampus and memories and all of this is that it allows us to create narratives. It allows us to really kind of stretch out and think about how time could unfold in order for us to be creative, right? And this is one of the kind of time manipulation things that we have the ability to do that allows for the success of our species, is that we have this ability to really think through an entire cause and effect relationship. Buonamamo has this great quote that he said about how he thinks that humans are the only ones that really understand pregnancy, because it's this cause and effect relationship where you have sex and then 9 months later, 10 months later, right, you have a baby. Like, do other animals actually put those two things together, right? And this, I think, is just something that makes the human brain fascinating in terms of our ability to, I mean, this is his whole, the human brain is a time machine. That's the title of his book, right? Is really this ability that we have to manipulate and construct these really interesting and weird time things in our brain.
Yeah, it's so interesting. He has another great quote that he says, if you were to unwisely summarize the function of the brain in three words, it would be anticipate the future. And I think that's a really great way to think about this. Like, our brain in so many ways is about anticipating the future, about especially as humans, like living our lives, we have to think about what are future conditions going to be like? How do I act in a way that is going to bring about a future that's more desirable than what it would otherwise be? And to do that, we have to engage in this kind of simulation, this future simulation that Taylor was just talking about. Now, only thing I'll mention is on the pregnancy in animals thing, I was thinking about that and I was like, I used to work with mice, and mice, it's like a 14-day gestation period. So it's only 2 weeks, right? But I get it, then I think, okay, well, that's like a really long time for a mouse. So maybe they don't put two and two together. But then again, there's not a whole lot going on in their lives. They're just like in their, you know, boring cages and stuff. So anyway, I might have to look deeper into whether other animals connect the pregnancy.
Right. And I don't want to like put it out there that like we're special, but it's a matter of extent. And I think that other animals have the ability to think about time, think about longer cause and effect relationships, but we have this incredible capacity for that we've developed, right? And so I think we're at about time for today. Yeah. sorry that it's taken some time for us to do this one. but this was a fascinating one to research. And I really hope that like everybody kind of came away with just some intuition of the wackiness of all of this, because it's weird when you really start looking at all of this. And like, we did a whole episode on free will, but this is one of those things that I've come across that makes it hard to like steer away from determinism. And I still have like my beliefs about that, but this one really kind of hit some chords with that one. So
yeah. Yeah. I hear you. I think that could be a whole nother conversation for next time, but you know, right. Next time, but I'll just say, I think that a lot of this that we're talking about, it hinges again on what is consciousness and what are we yeah. talking about when we say a perception is conscious or an action is conscious. And that could be a whole podcast, let alone another episode.
Right. All right. Well, thank you all for continuing to tune in. We very much appreciate the support. If you want to support us, we have a Patreon page. It helps us kind of keep up the research and keep doing these episodes. But we just enjoy kind of the engagement and people kind of wanting to learn more about how their brain works. So
yeah, we'll see you next time.
Awesome. See ya.